course, in choosing the topic for today's talk, Embracing Failure, I was, of course, really stepping in it. I have had to, and knew before I did this, that I was going to have to endure endless jokes about failure in preparation for this. The other night at the supper table, Diane asked me how my sermon was coming along, and I said, no, not so well. I responded, I have, at this point, only an outline. And she quipped, well, you can always claim that you're just embracing failure. So here goes. The roots of this sermon go back many years. In my parents' house next to the 1950s Encyclopedia Americana, bought volume by volume at the grocery store, I'm told, was a curious book. It was a full 2 inches thick and bound in a black fabric cover with worn gold lettering announcing the ambitious title, How Things Work. Not to be confused with David Macaulay's excellent book, more recently written, The Way Things Work, or the new The Way Things Work. Every other page of this book contained a detailed set of line drawings depicting the workings of every aspect of some modern, that would be 1960s, technology. From looms to computers, aluminum smelters to rockets, pianos to transistors. It was all there. On the facing page, across from the drawings, would be an exhaustive explanation of the technology depicted in detailed but non-technical language. I would spend countless hours poring through this tome, daydreaming and getting ideas for various sophisticated artifacts that I could recreate. With my Legos and my brother's Erector set and pieces scrounged out of my father's junk boxes and cans, I would set to work constructing or perhaps an electrical generator. The vast majority of these attempts ended in failure. Sometimes with the advice of my father or a trip to the library, I would discover some flaw in my design. And after reworking it, I would enjoy some measure of success. Sometimes I would discover that my Bible, How Things Work, had glossed over some detail that doomed my endeavor. For instance, the need for a serious oil diffusion vacuum pump to make an electron microscope work. Luckily, I had only spent a few days winding the focusing magnet coil before my dad pointed out that the Hoover we had was not going to cut it. On balance, there were more failures than successes, but nothing much was at stake, and I learned a lot about how things work. Later in life, I became a maintenance engineer in the broadcast video industry. My job was to build new facilities and to fix stuff that broke. A large part of repairing something is determining what went wrong with it. Almost as important, though, is to figure out what conditions of use or deficiency of design caused the equipment to stop functioning as it was expected to. I soon developed a deep appreciation for the ways complex electronics and mechanical equipment failed. I began to fantasize about writing the great American nonfiction book, How Things Fail. Failure comes in many forms. Tires blow out, cell phone signals don't penetrate hills. Our knowledge of a given subject may not match the expectations of an instructor on the final day of class. Our heart may be unable to receive sufficient oxygen to continue pumping blood. Clearly, all failures are not created equal. I will spare you Webster's or anybody else's definition of failure. Points off for failing to complete the amateur sermonist checklist. I will note two things, though, that I did observe. Far too many definitions of the word failure contain the the word failure in them. And two, most of the definitions give examples in the passive voice. I just thought that was curious. Failure surrounds us. Think of all the things in your house that are broken. Put aside the image of the cracked vase. I don't think we really want to say that it failed to maintain structural integrity when the cat knocked it off the table. That's not the sort of failure I'm talking about. I'm talking about all those things that stopped functioning while being used as they were intended to be. TVs, blenders, toasters, computers. Think also of the serious tasks that you have undertaken, those that you have not completed, or have met with some sort of impediment, real or imagined. Think about death. One could argue the ultimate failure. I don't intend for this to get too depressing. When I titled my talk, Embracing Failure, I was not envisioning a discourse on existential fatalism. Rather, let us think about what is of interest to take away from our failures. Without failure, there is no opportunity to learn. If by learning we mean the mastery of a subject, skill, or discipline, then to demonstrate mastery, we must iterate through a series of failures. If one attends school and is able to move seamlessly from success to success without error, all one has done is demonstrated that one is in the wrong curriculum. And you're wasting your time. When I teach computer programming to elementary school students, I encourage my students to try solutions to the problems that I set before them without knowing if those solutions are going to work beforehand. I often get complaints from my students. Mr. McCarthy, what I tried didn't work. What's the answer? More often than not, the answer is good, you failed. How does the result you obtain, though, differ from what you were looking for? Can you get there from here? Typically, further failures follow. But with each failure, some knowledge is gained. At the very least, the student now knows what doesn't work. In the end, when the student succeeds, and they always do eventually, they truly own the knowledge they have gained. Because they do not only know how to solve the problem at hand, but why that solution works. As an added benefit, they also have knowledge of near misses that might apply to other situations they find themselves in, and blind alleys that can be avoided in future. This sort of iterative failure is not unlike the scientific method. Now, just as an aside, last night, I wanted to make sure that I had a reasonable recollection of the scientific method, so I popped over to Wikipedia and found out that they have a fabulous article on scientific method, and you really have to dig through the article to find the, you know, sort of like canonical 5 or 7 steps that we were all taught in junior high. To review middle school science class, the scientific method goes something like this. Observe a phenomenon. 2, formulate a hypothesis to explain your observations. 3, make a prediction based on your hypothesis. 4, test your prediction. 5, evaluate the results of the test. Scientists do not ideally make value judgments should their hypothesis turn out to be in error. Rather, they iterate the process, modifying the hypothesis, making new predictions, and running new experiments until the hypothesis can be demonstrated to explain the initial observation. Failure is a constant process. Schools and laboratories, though, are special places. Places where failure can happen in a safe environment, in a controlled environment. When you get a calculus problem wrong, the negative consequences are usually not significant, leaving aside the question of your grades. However, the same error could lead to serious consequences in the so-called real world. Design errors have led to countless failures that have taken lives or caused injuries. So failure is not an option in the real world, right? Failure is always with us, though. It must be acknowledged, and it demands attention. Sometimes quite spectacularly. Have you ever had the brakes fail on your car? I have, in heavy traffic on Interstate 270. The event gave me the opportunity to contemplate my mortality in a way that no other auto-related incident has, not even actual collisions. Luckily, my car had a redundant system, a handbrake, that allowed me to control the car enough to get myself to safety and off the freeway. Failures can be scary. Trains have brakes too. In the early days, they were mechanical brakes and they only worked on the locomotive. This had a problem. Trains are big and go fast, and they're hard to stop. Well, in 1869, George Westinghouse, yes, that Westinghouse, came up with a clever invention. He created a system that used compressed air supplied to all the cars on the train that could apply the brakes throughout the entire length of the train simultaneously, or nearly simultaneously. It was a brilliant idea. For the first time, you were able to stop a train reliably in a relatively reasonable amount of distance. Trains became much safer. Except that there was a problem with this. He was using compressed air, which has to be delivered through the train by hoses. Well, as we all know, hoses leak. Sometimes they burst. When the hose delivering the compressed air to the train would leak or burst, the brakes on the train would fail. The consequences of the brakes failing on a train are far greater than on your car. Well, in 1873, Mr. Westinghouse had a better idea. What if instead of using compressed air to apply the brakes on the train, you used the compressed air to release the brakes on the train? In other words, the brakes would always be on unless you had compressed air to release them. Then, if the line that supplied the compressed air to the entire train were to leak or fail, the brakes would come on. They would fail in a safe mode. Similar devices have since been invented for the elevator. If, for some reason, the cable on an elevator breaks, there's a mechanism that prevents the elevator from moving, either up or down the shaft. Of course, we know which way the elevator wants to move. There are also other fail-safe devices that we may be familiar with. Everyone is familiar with fuses. The job of the fuse is to be the first electrical component to fail. Hopefully, saving your delicate electronics and/or your life. But more than just being something to be mindful of, failure can serve as a measure of aspiration. When we do our best work, when we strive our hardest, we are constantly flirting with failure. The limits of our abilities are sometimes hard to perceive. It is when we test these limits that we are able to do the most. But how do we know where those limits lie if we don't occasionally cross them? There is a story that is told about the early days after Steve Jobs returned to Apple Computers. He had left the company he co-founded to pursue other projects. In his absence, Apple fell on hard times, and some said it was near total failure. Well, Steve Jobs was convinced to return to the company, and shortly after his return, while touring a research and development group responsible for laptop design, he asked the lead engineer of the group what percentage of the projects that they had that they were working on had they brought to market in the last 5 years. The engineer proudly proclaimed that they had brought 100% of their projects to market. Much to the engineer's surprise, Jobs was not impressed. He said to the engineer that that sort of success rate meant that they weren't pushing the technology hard enough or challenging themselves deeply enough. Certainly, they did not want to sell defective computers to the public. But if they didn't push themselves to the point of occasional failure, they did not know what was possible. Perhaps the iPhone is not the pinnacle of human endeavor. Sorry, Kleber. But it and its clones would not have happened without lots of failures leading up to them. Failures serve to delimit our best achievements. Not only do people and things fail, but sometimes entire ways of thought fail. The Aristotelian model of the heavens became so baroque in attempt, that's baroque as in, you got it. Really, unintended. In an attempt to account for the more accurate observations of Kepler and Copernicus, that the system was abandoned altogether. Thus, an understanding of the universe as a heliocentric system, or sun-centered system, arose. In the last few centuries, even this concept has failed, as it became clear that not even our sun possesses a special place in the universe, but was simply one of millions, itself orbiting a galactic center, and those galaxies making up clusters that orbit around a common center. Newtonian dynamics was unable to explain the behavior of objects traveling at velocities that are a significant fraction of the speed of light. Thus was born special relativity. I will not presume to comment here on systems of political or social thought that have been swept away over the years. That's well above my pay grade. And there are others far more qualified among us to comment on that. Embracing failure has its limits. I will not try to convince you that all failure is some sort of karmic blessing. Assuming I know about proper tire maintenance, inflation, and hazard avoidance, I'm not sure what I'm going to learn from getting a from having a tire blowout on my car. Nor are failures, as I said earlier, created equal. I really don't know what lesson I'm going to learn when the front tire on my motorcycle blows out. But when we strive and fail, we begin to understand the contours of our reality more fully. Despite the happy pronouncements of inspirational gurus, all things are not possible. The human intellect cannot overcome all things. We are remarkable beings with remarkable capabilities and intellects, but we reside in a world with physical limitations and finite resources. Matthew Crawford, in his recent book, Shop Class's Soulcraft, takes a similar lesson from his work as a highly skilled motorcycle mechanic. Despite years of experience, he still finds problems that baffle his diagnostic skills and bolt heads that snap off. He sums up his humility by concluding, "The experience of failure tempers the conceit of mastery. I hope to learn what my failures are trying to teach me, regardless of whether those lessons are uplifting or humbling."